Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and the flaming tumbleweed has rolled right back in. We're ready for part two of this series.
That's right. If you didn't listen to part one, go back, give it a listen, because we get all into the topic of tumbleweeds, talking about what tumbleweeds are, what do we mean when we talk about them in the American sense, in a broader sense, why do they do the tumbling, and so forth. I think it was a pretty fun episode, and we're gonna keep the ball rolling today.
Now, one of the interesting things that we discovered in the last episode is that while the tumbleweed is an icon of the American West, the main species of tumbleweed, the thing people are usually talking about in the American context when they say a tumbleweed, is a plant known as Russian thistle that only arrived in the United States probably around the 1870s. And so this is not even native to North America. It's something that comes from the Eurasian steppe.
Yeah, it is very much an invader. It is an invasive species. And we're going to get into some of the ramifications of that here. But it's also one of the reasons why, if you look for like Native American accounts of tumbleweeds, they're not going to exist before a certain point, because they don't even come in with the initial colonists, with the initial influx of Westerners, or even the first few influxes of Westerners. They come in much later. However, you do find some interesting uses of tumbleweed. I was reading in the Journal of American Folklore a 1988 article titled "The Witches Were Saved, a Zuni Origin Story" by Dennis Tedlock. So the Zuni are one of the Pueblo people of the American West, and the author here discusses a work by the author Andrew Penesta, intended for oral performance. Penesta was a Zuni storyteller, and the story in question was apparently told in 1965, and then Tedlock is writing about it and discussing it. And it concerns interference by the U.S. military into Zuni affairs. But it mentions the tumbleweeds in a way that I think is rather clever and drives home their invasive and their invasive nature here. Quote, "There's a spot near Nutria where the soldiers camped. They fed hay to their horses, and there were tumbleweed seeds in it. Now only tumbleweeds grow on that spot, and they've spread all over."
Oh, so framing the soldiers here as a vector of the spread of this invasive plant.
Yeah, that's my read of it anyway. You know, it's touching on the foreign invasive nature of both both the American military presence here and the presence of Westerners in general, and the tumbleweed, both things that kind of curse the land in this viewpoint. Now, I was looking around for, you know, obviously to find older sort of folkloric takes and cultural takes on tumbleweeds, you have to go to the parts of the world where tumbleweeds were originally or would have spread to before they had a chance to take root in America, literally. I was reading The Rooster in the Transylvanian Folklore by Ferenc Pozsony, and in it the author writes, "On the Transylvanian plain, people used to believe that witches would cause aridity by burning a stolen rooster feather on the tumbleweed."
Oh, this is interesting. So the tumbleweed lore does go back, you know, to pre-modernity, but in the steppe region rather than in North America.
Yeah. And so I was looking around for more references to it, and I'm sure there's some good ones I missed. So anybody out there who's aware of any folkloric treatments of tumbleweeds from any part of the world, write in and share them with us. But I found mentions of tumbleweeds in Mongolian tradition, namely as the subject of traditional Mongolian riddles as collected and discussed in Mongolian Folklore, a representative collection from the oral tradition, part one. And this is by Hengen Kruger, Service, and Rozhecki, published in Mongolian Studies. And this came out, this is one of those volumes that came out like bridging 85 and 86.
Mm-hmm.
So they cover both Mongolian folk sayings and riddles in this paper. And this was actually a real pleasure to read. I know, Joe, you looked at it as well. It's almost like, I think I was telling you before we recorded, like I kind of want to see this bound as its own little paperback edition and available for purchase somewhere, because it's full of these fun little Mongolian folk sayings and then ultimately riddles, many of which are going to have resonance with readers anywhere in the world.
Right. Though some of which are completely like going to be lost on you if you don't know much about animal husbandry or goats or anything. But
right.
Other ones, they are very universal. And almost all of the sayings are great. So the first half of it concerns more like proverbs, you know, those kind of sayings that don't, they're not like a prompt in the way the riddle is. And a lot of the proverbs are really good. One of them that I'm just doing this from memory, but I think it was something like, load a donkey up with cargo, load a fool up with praise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're so good. Though obviously, they're emerging from a particular culture in a particular region. They speak very much to the environment and the cultures of the Mongolian people here. But the riddles here, they have a lot in common with riddle traditions around the world. The authors here write, quote, "The heart of the riddle is naturally the real or fancied resemblance between two ideas or things. Although sometimes punning plays a role when the similarity involves two or three words which sound alike." So I have a couple of riddles here. I'm gonna inflict them on you, Joe.
Okay.
And you may be able to guess the answer to a couple of them, but here's the first one. "When it comes from yonder, it looks like a camel. When it crawls under the wagon, it looks like a goat."
Okay, so I know the answer to this one, which is that it's a tumbleweed, but nonetheless, I don't get it. I don't understand why it looks like a goat when it crawls under the wagon. What do goats do under the wagon that is like, do goats kind of crack and break? Are they brittle under a wagon?
I don't know. I guess maybe they're just smaller. Like, I can definitely, my driving experience that I talked about in the last episode, I can definitely relate to the idea that the bumbling tumbleweed on the highway may look as big as a camel. It may be that intimidating. And then once you actually run it over, you're like, oh, well, that was more like running over a goat. One assumes.
Yeah.
I've never run over a goat.
I don't know why I laughed. It'd be very sad to run over a goat.
Oh, but, absolutely.
But for some reason, that was funny at the time. At the time, 10 seconds ago. but anyway, I do think this is one of the ones that is interesting because it seems to require some kind of localized knowledge that we don't really have. And this is something actually that the authors mention in their introduction to the section on Mongolian riddles. They say that You know, riddles are nearly universal in cultures around the world, and it's interesting to see what topics are the most common in each riddle culture. And so they say, for example, all cultures have riddles concerning astronomical phenomena, like the sun and the moon. But that when you look at Mongolian riddles in particular, they're going to be especially focused on topics like animal husbandry. So there will be riddles that have to do with camels and goats and horses and things like that. And obviously also localized plants will show up in a culture's riddles about nature, and the tumbleweed would be one of these.
Speaking of which, here's another riddle, Joe, from this collection. It travels by the wind. It stays in the ditch.
Now, this one I get more. Yeah, this is a tumbleweed. And I think the tickling, the brain tickling part of this, maybe that it's playing on your assumption when you say it travels by the wind, people are naturally primed to think about something other than like a plant or a feature of the natural world.
Yeah, something that actually lives in the air, something that flies in the air like a bird, or you're thinking maybe it's going to be something like song or something. But what does it mean it stays
or
in the
boat.
Ditch?
I thought of a boat.
That's a good one too. But no, it's the tumbleweed, which, this feels right as well. I mean, there is this thing that is pretty impressive when it really gets going, but it winds in a good ditch and it's done for.
Exactly. I mean, this calls to mind those images we saw last time of, 500 tumbleweeds all jammed into a culvert.
Yeah. All right, so Joe, you knew that the answer to those riddles was going to be the tumbleweed.
Right.
But I wanted to give you a shot at some non-tumbleweed Mongolian riddles here.
Okay.
So these I realize these may be a bit difficult, but we're going to give it a shot. Here's the first one. If I only had a tongue, I would be a witness. If I could only rise up, I could reach up to heaven.
Now, I saw this one before you read it, and I thought about it, and I honestly have no idea. So the second one is making me think it maybe is something that is long but not tall, I really don't know.
Well, you're on the right track, because the answer to this one is the road.
Oh, okay. Well, I certainly get the second half. If I could only rise up, I could reach up to heaven, if you could flip the axis. But what is it about the tongue? If I only had a tongue, I could be a witness.
I don't know. This one, they basically just explained that this one had to do with, they gave the answer, but they didn't explain what the tongue and the witness bit means. Maybe just because, so much happens on the road, that the road is kind of all-knowing in a sense. It connects to everywhere.
Yeah, it's like if these walls could talk, but there are no walls. If this road could talk.
Yeah, and in a sense, it is everywhere at once. This road that I am on is also in this distant city as well as the city I came from, and it's with me right here.
Interesting.
All right, here's one more. I have something. Others use it a lot, but I use it only occasionally.
Now, with this one, I also have no idea. I was trying to think in the animal agriculture kind of zone. Could this be something about, like a goat? Does a goat not use its own milk very much or something? I don't know.
Well, the answer to this one is my name.
Oh, that's very good.
Yeah.
That's very good. Yeah.
Yeah, the rationale being that generally you're not saying your own name as much as other people are saying your name.
But this is like not a good riddle if it's delivered by Bob Dole.
Right, yeah, or Dwayne the Rock Johnson, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Okay, well, I pulled out one for you. Rob, did you already see the solution to this one?
I'm probably not going to remember it.
Okay, it's just one line. The head is the enemy of its body.
Hmm.
What is it?
The head is the enemy of its body. Oh. Ooh, I don't know. Again, I'm thinking, and my mind is turning to cows and goats and horses, and I'm also, trying to think of like the great expanse of the Mongolian countryside, and I'm drawing a blank here.
I think I got us overly focused on bovidae and stuff. No. The answer is a matchstick.
Ah, well, that's pretty good.
So yeah, this has got to be a more modern riddle, I guess.
Yeah.
And I don't know when all of these come from. Like, do some of these date back hundreds of years, whereas others are, maybe from the 19th or 20th century?
Yeah, I get the impression that a number of them may be more recent.
Oh, and another one of them that I saw was pretty interesting was just the same one that appears in the, it's the riddle of the Sphinx from Oedipus. So that appears to be a cross-cultural riddle, you know, what has four legs in the morning, two legs in the noontime, and three legs in the evening. It is a human, you know, because you're a baby mm-hmm. and you crawl. And then as an adult, you walk on two legs, and then in old age, you use a cane. Oh, but I got one more for you, Rob. Okay. So this one is, on a sunny day, there are two. On a sunless day, there is but one. On a moonlit night, there are two. On a moonless night, there is but one.
I mean, I'm thinking about light and silhouettes, shadows.
Yeah, that's it. It's a shadow.
Is it a shadow? Okay, wait. Yeah, so it's
a person's shadow. There are two of you on a sunny day because you have a shadow.
Okay, I got that. Okay, and then on a sunless day, there's just you. There's no shadow.
Right.
On a moonlit night, there are two. Again, you have a shadow. And on a moonless night, it's too dark to see anything, right? Shouldn't there be nothing?
Oh, yeah, there shouldn't even be one. On a moonless night, there were zero. That'd
I guess
be even
the
better.
Stars are so bright. That's one thing I guess we have to consider. Mm-hmm. I don't know for certain, but it reminds me of things I've read about Egyptian mythology and about how an often unobscured sky is so central to sort of the worldview of, say, ancient Egyptians. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that holds true in Mongolian culture as well. Because if you have like this brilliant starlit sky and there's less probability of cloud cover, then perhaps that does illuminate things a little better. I don't know.
Yeah.
Certainly there's going to be less possibility of, you know, light pollution and artificial light kind of creating these deeper pockets of shadow.
But why does the tumbleweed under the wagon look like a goat?
I mean, maybe it just has to do with like once it gets up here, it's not going to, kick butt like a camel would. Like, it's going to be more or less hiding underneath the cart like a goat. It's not going to be this bounding, brave-looking thing. It's going to be this meek little ball that's hiding around underneath the carts or jammed under a wheel, et cetera.
Mongolian listeners, write in. Teach us. Help us figure this one out.
By the way, the sayings collected in this book in this paper are also great. Here's an example of one that kept jumping out at me every time I sort of skimmed past it looking for tumbleweeds. Men follow customs, dogs follow bones. I like that one.
Yeah, that is good. So if this implies a parallel in the way that these things are followed, would it be that humans go after social customs in a kind of driven, hungry, instinctual way?
You know, I'm not sure if that is the way we're supposed to take this, or does it mean that a dog like just follows their gut instinct and like, you know, follows immediate evidence, but men have customs that they have to follow?
That's it. That could be the contrast.
I find your interpretation interesting as well. I guess I could see it go either way.
I guess there's no comparative word in there. It doesn't say men follow customs like dogs follow bones.
Anyway, there are more of these, and if you're interested, again, it's Mongolian Folklore, a representative collection from the oral literary tradition, part one, and that's available on JSTOR. So if you go to jstor.org, you can access it for free. I don't know if you have to sign in. I access it via membership, but not a paid membership. So go for it if you're interested.
Okay, one more one before we move on.
Okay.
This is just a proverb. It's that children who grow up spoiled are more difficult to handle than a bull's neck.
Okay.
What about a bull's neck, though?
I guess it's difficult to get your hands around it, right? Bull's neck can be so thick that you can't even reach your arms around it and lock your knuckles together.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
All right, so we're gonna leave Mongolian wisdom aside here for a little bit. We're gonna get back to more North American tales of the tumbleweed. And so I was just thinking at this point you're probably going, well, geez, guys, I get that tumbleweeds are bad, and that sometimes they're like a camel and sometimes like they're a goat. Okay, fair enough. But what do they mean for the proliferation of radioactive waste? Well, we're glad you asked, because it's actually an interesting question. And one of the things I found even more fascinating about it is that the role that tumbleweeds play in our treatment of radioactive waste can vary greatly depending on like what source you're looking at.
Well, yeah, and I think the radioactivity will play more into the second example we're talking about than the first, which might be more clearly classed as a case of toxic waste.
Right. Yes. But both have to do with the leavings of the atomic age.
Yeah.
The atomic age, as we've discussed in the show before, especially I think the episode or episodes in question, it was titled The Atomic Scar. The atomic age has left various scars on the planet, including radioactive waste that we have to seal away and figure out how to symbolically warn apocalyptic wanderers 10,000 years in the future that they shouldn't mess with this because it's bad. So we're always looking at for ways to secure it, to re-secure it, to clean it up, etc. Now, you might remember another episode we did titled The Tide of Gold. And in that, we discussed some sort of novel gold harvesting schemes and ideas. And we discussed how plants can harvest gold from the ground. Basically, the premise here is that some plants have the ability to absorb minerals through their roots, and concentrate metals such as nickel, cadmium, and zinc. These plants are also known as hyperaccumulators. There are no natural gold hyperaccumulators, but there are ways to make it possible through soil manipulation. So you like treat the soil that contains the gold in a certain way, and you can sort of engineer it so that certain plants that have this natural ability will actually draw that gold up into their root system.
Mm.
So you can probably see where we're going here. Remember how we mentioned that tumbleweed roots can dive 20 feet down into the soil? Well, as pointed out by geologist Dana Ulmer Scholl of the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology in Socorro, reporting to the U.S. Geological Society in 2004, tumbleweed plants are actually really good at soaking up depleted uranium from contaminated soils at weapons testing grounds and battlefields.
Now, this is interesting. I guess we should do a little sidebar here on depleted uranium, because you might be wondering, okay, depleted uranium, and you hear that, you hear uranium, you hear weapons testing grounds, and you might naturally think like, oh, nuclear bomb detonation sites. But this is actually talking about something different. So depleted uranium is often used in heavy munitions as a metal, not as a fissile material for a bomb, but as a metal, and it's used in these munitions because of its density and armor penetrating properties. So it's, you know, you can make a very dense projectile out of it. I believe it is more than half again as dense as lead, something, it's like 60 something percent more dense than lead is. And that density also makes it useful for certain things in like the aeronautics field. I think I've read that it's used sometimes as a counterweight or counterbalance in some helicopter rotor blades. But it's also used for plating in armored vehicles, again, because it's dense, so it's more likely to stop a projectile, and then also in creating shielding against radiation. But as ammunition in particular, I think depleted uranium is used not just because it's dense, but because, say, when it hits the armor plating of a tank to try to penetrate it, it has these properties where it tends to kind of fragment in a way that makes the projectile sharper rather than blunter. Mm. And as it penetrates through the armor plating of an armored vehicle, it also tends to ignite and explode on the inside. So it has a lot of properties that you would want if you were trying to shoot through an armored vehicle. Now, to pick up on the caveat I was giving earlier about radioactivity, depleted uranium has very low levels of radioactivity. It actually has less radioactivity than is typically found in natural uranium. But uranium, whether natural or depleted uranium, has significant chemical toxicity. So it is clear that it is dangerous to ingest certain amounts of it beyond a certain threshold. But at least according to some sources, this is not really because of radioactivity, though there might be some continuing controversy about the radiological effects in particular. I'll mention a little more about that in a minute. But I was trying to look up, okay, how does it work? Well, according to the U.S. Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, or the ATSDR, which is a government agency under the umbrella of the Health and Human Services Department, they put out a fact sheet on the health effects of uranium, both known and under investigation. And they say that both natural and depleted uranium have the same toxic effects within a human body, the primary of which is adverse effects to the renal system, so the kidneys. So either inhaling or ingesting significant amounts of uranium compounds, and I think possibly by having it enter the body as shrapnel as well, this is known to cause damage to the kidneys, and there may be some secondary effects as well, but the secondary effects are less clear. The more I looked into this, the more complicated the picture of the health effects of exposure to depleted uranium became. So like you'll find a lot of debate. There are questions about the exposure of combat veterans and people living in war zones who have been exposed to ammunition with depleted uranium content. And I did not have time to wade into all of that controversy and figure out what I thought about it. But I will say, at the very least, you do not want your body exposed to high levels of depleted uranium, definitely because of its known adverse health effects, and then there may be other secondary effects on top of what is currently known as well. But like most things, the toxicity of depleted uranium depends on dosage over time. So we're all exposed to tiny amounts of uranium from the natural environment on a consistent basis. This is completely unavoidable. It's just part of living on planet Earth. There's going to be tiny, tiny amounts of uranium in the food you eat and the water you drink. But if you are living in certain areas where there is significant uranium contamination in the environment, those levels could go up above what is safe.
Right. And therefore, it stands to reason if you had, say, a former ammunition testing ground and you wanted to do something else with that and not just keep it, set aside for, the duration of human civilization or something, you might want to reclaim it. You might want to find a way to get depleted uranium out of the ground. And that's where a few different plants have shown promise at drinking up that depleted uranium. One of them, for instance, is the Indian mustard plant. But as this research points out, one of the things about many of these plants is that they thrive in wetter soils. What are you going to do when you have something out in a desert, right? Well, that's where the tumbleweed comes in. The tumbleweed, of course, famously excels in dry, barren places. One rolls into a well-irrigated yard in a New Mexico suburb, and it's doomed. It can't compete with the grass, but if it goes into an abandoned a feedlot or some sort of a agricultural site, an undeveloped badland, well, then that's where the tumbleweed is king. And so it's ideally suited for some of the desolate places that we find depleted uranium in the United States, especially in the West, in the Western states. So the argument here is that this could be a safe method as well, because the plants do most of the absorption well before they detach. So if you were managing the site, if you were planting intentionally the tumbleweed plants here, then the plants could be harvested and disposed of well before the drying phase begins, and then ultimately the tumbleweed breaks free and is able to roll free.
Exactly. And so I thought this was very interesting. I did look around for more follow-up on this about using tumbleweeds for remediation of heavy metals like depleted uranium or other toxic substances in soils. And I didn't find anything much more recent. So I don't know if or how much anybody's picked up on this research. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, like we hinted at before, this is something we often see with tumbleweed-related research. Somebody will have an idea about something we can do with the tumbleweeds. What can we do with these tumbleweeds? What can we do about these tumbleweeds? And someone will have a novel approach, but either it's something that doesn't seem to work out for one reason or another, or it requires more research and is perhaps still being researched. It seems like I saw this more often than not.
Oh, did we ever find anything else out about what happened to that tumbleweed eating machine we talked about in part one?
No, not yet. But as we're recording this, the first episode has not aired. So I'm hoping that we'll hear from some New Mexico listeners. Like maybe there are counties in New Mexico where they had one of these or have one still. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll get some local intel. I did email one of the researchers who was involved in the original project and the original prototype. But I have not heard back from them, and nor would I be that surprised, because just some rando is reaching out to them out of nowhere and asking them about a project that they worked on decades ago. Yeah. I can understand they might see that as just a spam email. All right, so we're not done with the idea of tumbleweeds and weapon sites and so forth. And this week turned to an article that you dug up, Joe. This was from Sarah Zhang, writing for Gizmodo back in 2014, which was just a really great year for all things tumbleweed. A number of the articles that we have end up referring to in this come from 2014. Mm-hmm. But she cited a George Johnson piece in National Geographic, particularly this bit. Quote, during the early 1960s, after above-ground nuclear testing finally ceased at the Nevada test site, the first thing said to grow back was Russian thistle. Radioactive salsola has come tumbling out of the old Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington, where plutonium was manufactured during the Cold War. I half expect to hear someday that Russian thistle has been found on the moon.
Yeah, and I can't remember if we already said it so far in this episode or not, but Russian thistle is the common name of the main species of tumbleweed that is now known in the United States. Number of different scientific names have been used. Salsola tragus, Calli tragus, and this is the Salsola that the author here is talking about in this this Nat Geo piece that's being quoted. But yeah, it is not surprising to me to hear that tumbleweed is the first thing moving in at a nuclear testing site.
Right. And as Zhang explains, it's just one of many organisms that can interfere with our efforts to set aside such wastes and such wayside, or just sort of secure such locations. Now, the Hanford Nuclear Reservation is of note here because it and tumbleweeds were in the news as recently as January 2020, as reported by Maria Kramer in the New York Times, with the headline, "Storm of Tumbleweeds Buries Cars, Terrifies Drivers, and Astounds Police." But I have to point out that some places, including, I believe, the Chicago Tribune, altered the headline, or updated the headline, I would say. I don't want to say altered, like they did something super nefarious, to say, "Storm of, quote-unquote, nuclear tumbleweeds buries cars, terrifies drivers, and astounds police." It's in quotes because they're referring to a particular quote in the original article where they're talking about this Tumbleggeddon, in which they mention, quote, "The highway is in a flat, wide-open area close to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, which is known as one of the sites of the Manhattan Project and where plutonium was produced to help build the atom bomb." And then there's this quote from a Mr. Thorson that says, quote, "Some people are calling them nuclear tumbleweeds." So that's
that might be jumping to some conclusions here, but not entirely without reason.
Right. Yeah, the article does not discuss tumbleweeds as radioactive in nature, other than including that one little quote. But the Hanford location, as discussed by Elliot Marshall in a 1987 edition of the journal Science, has pointed out that this is a location that has had issues with badgers, rabbits, ground squirrels, burrowing owls, pocket mice, insects, rabbit brush, and yes, tumbleweeds interfering with human efforts to sort of leave this site alone and undisturbed.
Well, yeah, they're literally having breaches due to wildlife, like failures of nuclear material or high-level waste containment due to breaches by things like badgers.
Yeah, and then things like rabbits with like radioactive rabbit poop because rabbits have gotten in there.
Yes.
Here's a quote from Marshall. "With roots that can grow down 20 feet, tumbleweeds reach down into waste dumps and take up strontium 90, break off, and blow around the dry land. And this caused some to worry that the radiation in the tumbleweeds could then be released into the air if these weeds were to do what tumbleweeds sometimes do, collect somewhere and then catch fire. Or what happens if they reach a body of water? Remember that example from the last episode talking about a tumbleweed, this mighty tumbleweed rolling into the water and then kind of melting there. You know, you don't want your radioactive shredded wheat hitting the milk.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, so it's not necessarily actually known that these tumbleweeds from this story in January 2020 had significant radioactivity levels, but tumbleweeds are one of the biological vectors that could potentially breach some types of nuclear material containment.
Right, that seems to be the case.
And of course, the fact that they then break off and blow around afterwards is not helpful.
Right. And, I mean, we do have to acknowledge the fact that there are radioactive tumbleweeds in the video game Fallout New Vegas. So, I don't know.
Is that true? The tumbleweeds?
Apparently. I played New Vegas, and I remember enjoying it, but I do not remember the tumbleweeds. I had not yet fostered an appreciation for the tumbleweed. So, if they were there, I forgot them, but I ran across this in my searches. So, it seems to be the case.
Well, I'd say good on them what was the team that made that game? They did the research.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics, in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Now, given all we shared about the problems posed by invasive tumbleweeds in the United States, it should come as no surprise that the USDA has looked into ways of eradicating them, or at least significantly reducing their number. And they've some of the ways they've examined this are rather interesting. One method that has been proposed is to take the classic approach and introduce a particular type of mite. This is Assyria salsolae, which kills the growing tips of the plant and stunts it. Supposedly, studies have shown that it only targets this particular mite species. It only targets a few closely related species to the tumbleweed, and all of these species are pest species.
Oh, but the proposed biological controls do not stop there.
That's right. They've also researchers have also looked into using two fungi species native to the tumbleweed's original, Russian or Ukrainian environment. This news was making the rounds in 2014. They've also looked into viral methods of targeting invasive tumbleweeds with viruses. The USDA was also testing viruses developed from two types of dying tumbleweeds in Russia and in Hungary. And this was also reported in, again, 2014, just a banner year for tumbleweed research. Now, I'm not sure where we are with any of these different approaches. The 2014 ones, anyway, I mean, that's not too long ago. It seems feasible that there still could be some research going on there. Maybe it's a situation where the research did fizzle out, or maybe there's just a lot of contemplation that has to go into the massive introduction of another invasive species or some sort of other biological control to try and take care of your existing problem. Because you don't want to overflow the tub any more than it's already overflowing.
You know, I was just trying to remember which previous episode we talked about some of the controversies of using, you know, different species for biocontrol methods of existing invasive species. And the one that came to mind that looked, at least the time we talked about it, like it was going pretty well was on Christmas Island, where the big native crab populations, or wait, were those crabs originally from somewhere else as well? I don't recall. But anyway, the crab populations on Christmas Island, the glorious flows, the ocean, the tide of crabs, they were being threatened by these ant populations there that were, you know, squirting formic acid into the crabs' joints and killing them. I think they were the yellow crazy ants, right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, so the yellow crazy ants, there were some conservationists who had developed a plan to help try to control populations of the yellow crazy ants by deploying a predator, a predatory micro wasp that would cut back on the ant colonies there. And at least last time we read about that, it seemed like that was going well so far and had not had any dangerous spillover. But yeah, you always wonder, like, you don't, you know, first order of business is do no harm. And it's always a little risky when you say, well, let's introduce a different thing and just hope that it only has this targeted effect that we want it to.
Yeah, I mean, time was when human beings thought they could fix a problem by introducing a new invasive species, they would just do it. Yeah. and a lot of times that would end up resulting in a new problem, a new invasive species. So it's good that we're being more thoughtful about this, because ultimately you're dealing with a very complex ecosystem in any case. And it's difficult to figure out exactly what the ramifications of introducing something new are going to be, or to introducing another new thing into it.
Oh, but I just recalled, I'd been trying to remember what was the example we talked about in that episode of a biocontrol species that had been introduced and then really backfired, and I couldn't call it to mind, but I just did. It was the cane toads in Australia.
Ah, yes.
That were brought in, I think, to control beetle populations that were threatening agriculture, but then the cane toads became a huge problem in their own right.
Yeah, yeah, there are so many different accounts one can turn to where we can are cautionary tales in introducing new species to try and fix a problem, and then you know, another aspect of all of this too is that things change, environments shift. For instance, I was looking at a University of California Riverside study from 2019. And this was making the case that the quote-unquote monster tumbleweed species, Salsola rayani, was once thought to be actually going extinct, but it has since gained ground as it apparently remains green into late summer and has increasingly been able to take full advantage of rains during that time period. So its footprint has been expanding in recent years, and this is one that grows up to 6 feet tall. So it's a massive tumbleweed. But I guess a footnote in the lesson that, you know, you can try and solve one particular problem at a certain period of time, but what is the situation going to look like, say 10 years down the road, especially when we're looking at climate change and other factors having an impact on the natural environment. But then again, maybe I'm wrong, and like as we're recording this, somewhere on the roads in New Mexico, there is a massive snowplow with an enormous a grinder on the front of it. And in the back of that snowplow, there are a whole bunch of mites and viruses and fungi, and it's just making a beeline for the tumbleweed nation. So I don't know.
Sorry, I'm thinking now about the 6-foot-tall tumbleweed. Okay, so I'm imagining somebody trying to like get that with a pitchfork. How heavy does that get? I know the tumbleweeds are typically very low density, right? Because they need to be able to be blown mm-hmm. by the wind. But I don't know, once you're 6 feet wide, you also have a lot of surface area to catch the wind. So you could probably be pretty heavy and still get blown around. Like how hard does it get? Can they just get bigger and bigger and bigger?
I mean, they are mostly air, but that being said, if I had to choose between hitting a 4-foot diameter tumbleweed with my rental car or hitting a 6-foot diameter tumbleweed with my rental car, I'm definitely going to swerve towards the 4-foot diameter tumbleweed. That being said, again, if you're driving and the tumbleweeds come at you, don't swerve. That's where the problems really start.
I suppose I'm imagining runaway tumbleweed evolution where they, you know, 10-foot tumbleweed, 30-foot tumbleweed, 100-foot tumbleweed, and eventually the planet is ruled by gargantuan tumbleweeds. They create their own culture.
You know, coming back to, you know, cinematic uses of tumbleweed that we touched on earlier on, it does seem that it's the symbol, the iconic scene is that lone tumbleweed making its way across the screen. I don't think I've ever seen, or I don't remember ever seeing a cinematic treatment where it is like a whole herd of tumbleweeds, but mm-hmm. that is the more impressive sight. And in a way it would seem to drive home the desolation. Not only is this place so desolate, that one tumbleweed is coming by, it is just taken over. All life is tumbleweed here.
I bet you could make a really good sentient tumbleweeds horror movie. That, yeah.
Well, we were discussing this a little bit off mic the other day. I wonder to what extent or any extent the Critters franchise has any connection to tumbleweeds. I mean, those Ooh. Are films that originate out of Texas. The first one was set in Texas, I believe.
Oh, I forgot that.
So I couldn't find anything just offhand. I didn't go deep and start listening to directors' commentaries or anything. But, mm-hmm. You know, those creatures, the Krites, they're kind of like little tumbleweeds. And they roll together. They join together into big tumbling pods. They're kind of like tumbleweeds as creature. And they're invasive. Yeah, they're from another planet. I put it out to you, the listener. Have you directed a Critters movie? If so, write in and let us know what you think about the comparison between a Krite and a tumbleweed.
Are you Leonardo DiCaprio?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Were Leonardo you in DiCaprio a Critters movie?
Was in Critters 2. The Critters franchise has a lot of talent in it. If you start really looking at some of the names involved, mm-hmm. especially on the acting end of the spectrum, it's star-studded.
Which is the one where they just like go to a buffet restaurant? Isn't there one where they do that?
I don't buffet? Know. The Critters movies are. It's one of those franchises where I don't think I've ever sat down and just watched a full Critters movie. It's just they would come on TV a lot back in the mm-hmm. day, and so when Critters was on, you just watched some Critters. And I'm not sure, at what point I was jumping in and out of the series.
The other day you pointed out that there's one Critters movie where they go to space, which is yep. a little underwhelming because the Critters are from space. They're aliens.
Yeah.
But it's like it makes sense for when Jason goes to space. That's weird. You leprechaun in space. Okay, that's weird. But now this is like aliens in space.
Well, yeah, maybe it's a little odd, but it's where you got to go. It's like they went Critters 1, Critters 2, Critters 3, they go to L.A., Critters 4, they go into space. I don't know where they go after that. I think there was a TV series recently.
Oh, I think they go on the Odyssey then, right? They're trying to return home to Ithaca.
Maybe so. All right. We're going to go ahead and call it there. This is going to be the end of our 2-episode series on tumbleweeds. But again, we'd love to hear from everyone out there, especially those of you who live in tumbleweed country, which you know, technically, if you look at a map, includes, you know, most people in the United States. But at any rate, we'd love to hear your tidbits and your experience with the mighty tumbleweed, whether it be coming at you like a camel or hiding under the cart like a goat. In the meantime, if you would like to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, well, you can listen to us in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We have core episodes in there on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Mondays, we do listener mail. On Wednesday, we do a short form artifact or monster fact episode. And on Fridays, we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a strange film. We have a number of different web presences, but if you you know, you look us up on the iHeartRadio page, or you just go to stufftoblowyourmind.com, or if you just go to I think the Instagram page, any of the others, there's often going to be a link there for merchandise. If you want to check that out, that's just kind of a fun way to celebrate the brand. If you want a shirt or a mouse pad or a throw pillow with our logo on it or some other various designs, go check that out. We're going to see about possibly adding some more designs this year. So also, yeah, write into us and let us know if there's any kind of Stuff to Blow Your Mind merch that you think should exist. Likewise, I don't know if there's any merch from our show that you think should not exist. Let us know, and we'll make sure not to create that.
Should we create designer tumbleweeds, which we send to you by wind mail? Obviously not. Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.